Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
The quiet week for news until a few hours ago.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
Yep. No Mikhail this week. It's middle of the night for him, so understandable. And also, thank you all for covering for me last week. Just had a surprise friend back in town for the first time in a few years. And then what was supposed to be a short morning thing ended up being an all-day thing, so I couldn't make it in time for the standard recording. So thank you, Adam and Josh and others, for covering for me last week. So this week, we're recording this on August 1st. It's the kind of like the last week before Deluge of Games starts in August, ahead of like Beast of Reincarnation in a few days, and then all the other August, September, October releases from that point. For the discussion topics this week, we're going to start out with the Rare Chow review. Chow just put up a review on the site for Blue Reflection Quartet. He'll go into what that game is and what he thought about it. Of course, we're also just a few days removed from the Xenoblade 2 Switch 2 edition. Obviously, all the news on that about its new Rare Blade, new side quest, and that just launched. So we'll talk about some opinions on that. And then anyone who's listened to the podcast over the last couple months has known that I've been kind of playing through the Divinity games in a little bit of a quiet, you know, backlog month for me. So I've continued my efforts on that. So in kind of that game three slot, I'll talk a little bit about my status on the Divinity games I played out of my backlog. We'll at least point out some, even though he's not on the podcast, some interviews that Mikhail put together from CD Projekt about Cyberpunk, about Edgerunners, and all sorts of things. We'll talk about some news involving Super Robot Wars, a game that I played 8 years ago that I wasn't expecting to see in the news again, showed up as a headline, so we'll talk about that. And a few other things kind of to round out, you know, the sales, the dates, and trailers, and all that sort of stuff. Without further ado, we'll lead off rarely with Chow here to talk about Blue Reflection Quartet. Now, we talked right before we pressed record. I kind of admitted to the group that I'm not 100% sure like what this game is. I looked it up that it's a Gust game from 2017, but you wrote up a review for Quartet. So for those that aren't in the know, tee us up what Blue Reflection Quartet is and what your general thoughts of were on it.
So Blue Reflection is, what is it? It's part of Gust's lineup of games. They started this thing called like Beautiful Girl Project or something, that's what they call it. And then there was like Knight of the Azure is one of the game of the franchise, and then the last project came out of it was Blue Reflection. So this is like, a if you look at the cover, you see a girl with an inner girl of herself wearing like magical girl's clothes, and you're like, what could this be? And so people were kind of curious, and eventually the game came out, right? So it's like RPG that takes place in modern times, right? I think to start off with, so Quartet is a compilation of all of the Blue Reflection games that has ever came out before it, right?
Oh, are there four of them? Is that why
no,
it's Quartet?
No, that's a thing. No, only two Blue Reflection games came out for console. One yes. For mobile, and then the one anime, not adaptation, but it's like its own whole separate thing. It's a Blue Reflection anime that's not based on anything else, all original.
So I was gonna say, I did the review for Blue Reflection 2. We did talk about it in this podcast, but it's been maybe, I don't know,
about five years,
but it's been pretty long. Oh, wow. I think it's been 4 years, so it's easy to see why you would forget about it. So, but we did talk about Blue
Terrible. Yeah,
we did talk about Blue Reflection 2 on this podcast before. So, but anyways, I think the original was reviewed by Zach. He's
alumni Zach who's been at Sega for quite a while. So you know it was from another era that the first Blue Reflection came out. Been quite a while, almost 10 years.
Yep. It's almost 10 years. It came out in, what is it?
2017.
Yeah. It's almost a decade, but not a decade because it came out in September. So it's reaching there. So it feels old. It's actually like one of the first few guides I wrote on a NeoSeeker because they were looking for like source materials to write. And they always like suggest like random games. So I actually like suggested Blue Reflection just because I wanted just try it because I was curious about what it was, right? So
like you're kind of returning to like almost not like your roots, but it's like kind of like Blue Reflection does mean something to you.
Yeah, like I'll give you a history of me with guide writing. So I was hired in that site because they saw my Trails guide and they want me to write something. I think they suggested Vicaria Revolution, and that was a massive bomb. So after that, they don't suggest projects. In fact, they asked me for games that I should write instead. So I think they learned a lesson from that game. So I suggest the Blue Reflection, and then I kind of work from there, right? So it's like actually one of my first guides. And it's not a very good guide, in my opinion, from the writer himself, just because it's just like, how'd I say it? I wasn't really used to like using the site's tools, so it felt kind of bare bones when I wrote it. So
you were a young man at the time.
I mean, yeah, that's theoretically natural for everyone to, you know, their first output is not going to be their best output.
And it's like even like the Cold Steel Free guide, it's one of like my weakest guides in my opinion, just because I was struggling to figure out how to use their tools. And I think if you compare it to like my Trails first chapter guide in Cold Steel Free, it's like almost like a night and day difference on how it's written, right?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, so I think the best is to start with the first Blue Reflection. I actually like the first Blue Reflection. I know I kind of like a bit harsh on it if you kind of see like review. But the first one is, how do I say it? It has a very endearing main character in my opinion. So basically, it starts in this, what is it? This main character, her name is Hinako. She basically goes to school and the reason she hates or she doesn't want to go to school because she used to be like a ballet prodigy and she basically had like a little knee injury and then she couldn't really do ballet anymore, so she just like, forget it, my life is over, I don't want to
well school. Not a little knee injury, like a pretty significant one that she couldn't do ballet anymore,
and yeah, that
affects her a lot because ballet was a big part of her.
Yeah, so she just doesn't want to come to school anymore, and then when she goes to school a fan comes in, it's like, hey, you're that, it's like, you're Hiroko Shirai, and like, I'm a big fan, you know, and then she's kind of like trying to like brush her off, and you know, after that interaction caused her to like kind of go crazy, and then boom, she gets sucked into like this alternate world, right, like this, like, and then she's like, what the hell is going on here, and then there's like monsters, and then she has like a ring that comes out of nowhere in her hand. And then she's able to turn into this magical girl, which is like Reflector, and she has like all these supernatural powers, and she can like super jump and all this kind of stuff in this reality. And then goes the monster, whatever, goes back to reality, and everything's back to normal. Like this whole thing never happened. And she's like, "What is going on?"
And that's kind of like an ongoing theme where emotions plays a big part of the whole franchise.
Like,
emotions are like, and like the creatures that you're fighting and the realm that you're in. It's very closely tied to like the emotional connection for people's backgrounds, histories, traumas, and their relationship with like, how they you know, deal with that, you know, a very troubled thing that they're struggling with mentally. It's kind of like the like kind of the big thing throughout all these.
I'm not sure they like took a page from Persona, because I think Persona was a very big thing back in that time, so it's like it feels very Persona inspired when people go kind of ballistic all the time. You're like, oh, this isn't me.
I wouldn't say it's like directly, you know, sure, Persona kind of had a hand in it, but these concepts existed before Persona. This is not like a new thing.
I think they popularized it, right? So I don't know. I just feel like during that time when I play, I feel like, oh man,
I'm always on the hesitant side of like, oh, this was definitely inspired by Persona. I'm like, you know, these types of things happened before Persona, but I can see where people are coming from.
So yeah, that's basically like the first chapter, and then after a couple chapters later, she meets like these two mysterious twins, and they kind of like tells her like what they do. Like, they're basically the exposition dump, and they kind of tells her like, you know, it's like there's like these dark spirits called the Spira or something, or Ephiroth. I don't know what the hell they call it in translation technically, but they call them, and then they tell them it's like eventually there, if you manage to defeat them all, you could get one wish granted, right? And when she heard that story, she's like, okay, I'm doing this because I want to restore my legs. And you know, bring back how life used to be for me. That's kind of like her motivation. And that's kind of like the rest of the first game. And I think one of the things I do like about the first game is the main character is very nonchalant, is straightforward. And then I think that gets her into trouble because every time like there's something bad that happens, it's usually because she was being a rude person to someone else. Because every time everyone talked to her, she's like, oh yeah, it's like, too bad, so sad. It's like, what about me? It's like, I don't care. And then the girl goes ballistic. It's like, oh shit, okay. All right, sorry, I didn't really mean what I did. It's like, I was just, you know.
I'm like, and part of the legacy of that first Blue Reflection that people always, you know, look back on is definitely the screen presentation layout, the HUD overall, very clean, a lot of diamonds, and the OST, very OST for nice sure. piano. Yeah, very nice piano.
I believe very ephemeral. I forgot his name. I think it's, he became like the main music composer for like Atelier Ryza as it goes on. So. His music is absolutely awesome, so it's like, you know, it's like I could see why they start using him in Ryza.
But yeah, Hayato Asano.
Yeah, he became, I think this is like the first work that he start working with Gus, and it's like he's good. So, that's kind of like the first Brian. Game.
Yeah,
I was gonna say, I was just gonna ask, like, so how does Blue Reflection Quartet fit into this? Like, maybe it's
you
obvious,
get the whole game. You get the whole game. You get the whole first Reflection game in here, right?
Oh, okay.
Yes. So the first day. So I guess that this is where, like, you shouldn't probably try to detail every single Blue Reflection game because it, you know, they're all their own works. And the I guess where this should go is like Quartet, the Quartet version of Blue Reflection 1 and 2. There are some changes from the original version in terms of like new features, and as you mentioned in your review, there's also some censorship that you noticed as well in these new versions. So I kind of want to lead into that conversation. It's like, okay, there's a new release Quartet. These games have already come out. What should people expect from these updated versions of these games that have already come out?
Oh, in this version, you can fast forward the game, because one of the things I do not like in the original game is how slow that Hinako moves. It's like, okay, lore-wise, it could make sense. I mean, she gipped her leg, but it's like, you're running really slow. So it makes navigation very, like, a pain to get through.
Diegetic leg injury.
But, I mean, technically she's running, I mean, I guess, but yeah, they added a fast forward option so your character can be moving a lot faster. And then they added some glossary, because I think that game had a lot of, like, term. I mean, they called their, you know, like, isekai, like, emotional world, whatever, they call it the common. So there's lots of, like, terminology gambles, so they added, like, a glossary so you could read that. And obviously, because then there's like multiple games, there's also a reference list. You could like look at this chart and see like everyone that's connected and who they're related to. So it's like lots of like those things, right? But I think the biggest of all is there's a censorship. I know people that want to pick up this game because they heard about the censorship. So what happened is in there's lots of like these like shower scenes where like these girls is having these bonding moments. And, you know, in the original, they'd be just probably wearing their, you know, underwear or something like that. And here it's like they're wearing like a bath towel. And the water used to be like transparent. And now the water looks like a bunch of muddle and see-through.
Yeah, so yeah, I heard like, yeah, I saw like the transparency effects are pretty much gone. They were like see-through, like, you know, like replicating the effect as I would reflect in the real world. But, you know, due to it, you know, international regulations, and, you know, updated modernized standards, let's say, common vernacular. It's one of those things that, like, in the context of this, I can see it harming the work because, like, there's a work that features an all-female cast, and part of the appeal to it for a good chunk of its audience is that, you know, female-to-female relationship. And, you know, when you're just chatting with people that you're comfortable with, especially in the same sex, you know, it's perfectly, like, I mentioned this similarly when this was first revealed. It's like, it would be natural to wear, like, you know, either underwear or even be naked because you're, like, changing into, some, like, other clothes and stuff like that. But because, you know, obviously there'll be players that have a more voyeuristic approach to this game, and due to some international laws and some territories, you know, like clamping down on stuff like this, and this is an international release, they only want one SKU, of the game. It leads into, like, you know, this clash of, like, how do we have this work come out there yet still comply, you know, within the laws of most territories, what is acceptable there. And they don't want to, you know, release multiple versions of
it. I mean, it makes perfect sense, but it's kind of a shame just because of how it goes.
It does
but...
damage the intent. I agree.
The way you're describing it, the game doesn't present it like voyeuristically. Is that an adjective?
Yeah, it's not really. I don't know it doesn't.
Yeah, it just seems like they're in a shower. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Or maybe Hinako's in the bathtub and she's just like rubbing water in her knee, and you know, it's like, cause you know, something like that, right? It's like it's not perverted anyway.
It's not presented as that, but obviously people who play these works, some of them obviously will be perverted, and that's, you know, that's not a new thing in games. That has been ever since, you know, games were a thing. So, and that's something you can't control, and I think that's something that's like it. That's not really on the player's fault. It's just like more of how standards have been modernized in my opinion, kind of like an unfortunate route where it's very puritanical.
That's what we had to deal with. So anyways, that would be the first game. I know this is kind of like a very rough summary of the first game, but
yeah,
I think you did it pretty well.
Good summary. Yeah.
But now we move on to the second game, which is Blue Reflection Ray. So that is an anime.
Well, okay, hold on. Before you have to clarify, because like when you say second game, you mean in this collection, because technically the second game is Blue Reflection Second Light. But
yes,
in the recommended play order of this game.
As soon as you boot this game out, it has a bunch of text that tells you should play these games in this following order, because that's how the story goes chronologically, right? That's what they said. So the second game chronologically is Blue Reflection Ray. This used to be an anime that aired about 5 years ago, and it has like 24 episodes done by JC staff. So that sounds pretty big. And I didn't want to watch it because that's pretty long commitment.
I watched it. I mean, it's not bad. It's not great. It's okay. It has some neat ideas, but it's very okay.
So when you hear that, you know, this thing will be in the package, I'm like, yes.
I was interested. That's something that made me interested in this package. I was like, oh, that's really cool. That, like, here's what I thought when they said this. I thought they were gonna do like a game adaptation of like letting you like play the events of the anime. Like, you can actually, like, it's a full game. That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's what I thought too, and that's why
I'm also interested. I never thought they were gonna do that, because I know how sometimes Gus and Koei Tecmo cut corners. I was like, not a second. I was like, they were going to do a full game on this shit. So.
James was totally right. So what you got was a complete piece of dump. I don't know how to describe this part of the package. This
piece of dump.
It's the worst piece of crap that I played of this collection. Okay, so basically you start at the end of the storyline, near the end. You're basically having like the two main characters, Hiyori and Ruka, and they're like fighting the main antagonist, Shino? I believe that's her name.
I forgot.
Okay, anyways, they get their ass kicked, and they're like, they lost all their memories. And then the twins from the original game comes out and is like, hey, it's like, you had to collect these memory fragments to get your powers back. And then you're like, okay. You're basically wandering these fields, and you look for like these fragments. And as soon as you click the fragments, you get like this little picture from the anime. It's like, hey, do you remember so-and-so, this person, this sister? It's like, yeah, they bake us a cake or something. I'm like, who the hell are these people? I don't know.
This sounds like a fucking Dragon Quest Die situation.
It does sound like that.
Fuck. Not and good.
And then you're like, I have no idea who the fuck these people are, and I don't know what the hell is going on. And then you're like, next fragment, hey, do you remember your sister used to do this? I'm like, who is this person's sister? I don't know any of this. There's no context.
This fucking sucks.
And then eventually when you kick all your fragments, they get their uniforms back, and then they confront like Shino again, and they kick her ass, and then the game's over. And you're like, wait, that was it? That's it?
How long is this?
It took me 30 minutes to beat it. I read some reviews, they took an hour, but it took me 30 minutes for me. Yes. It was awful.
I feel like what should have happened was you press the blue reflection ray selection on the main menu, and it gives you like a trailer of the anime, and it says go watch it on the streaming service. That should have been.
I think they should have just done that. It's like, here's a subscription or, to Crunchyroll. Go watch it or something.
Or like, I don't know, fucking fit it in the fucking disc or have separate discs or just a separate download for those. Like anything else but this. It seems like the worst fucking way to do this. Great. So the thing that I was interested in was one of the worst parts about it. A good package so far.
I was going to say, like, you do not pick up this if you want to get that of the collection, okay? So, the next game after this is that they suggest you to play is Blue Reflection Sun, okay? That's that used to be a mobile gacha game that they made. It's end of service now, and now they have, like, kind of retool it, turn it into a single player with its gacha elements missing. And that's Blue Reflection Sun. Oh,
okay, wait, hold on. Does this actually turn it into, or is it like super stripped down and not doesn't have like all the stages of mechanics from it?
It's the latter. It's super stripped down. It plays like Blue Reflection 2. I know Blue Reflection 2 is the best of their games, but this is some weird Frankenstein Blue Reflection 2. So it took the combat system from Blue Reflection 2, and then they cut out all, like, the, you know, like, events on how you, like, do it in, like, the gacha game, but instead you interact with the characters to get the events, and any, like, romantic undertones from the original gacha game is completely removed, because apparently mm-hmm. you play as a male protagonist, yeah, and the Japanese fans were not happy with that. They want the whole Yuri kind of story, not, like, any, like,
it wasn't just the Japanese fans that hated that. I heard nothing but disdain.
It was pretty universally hated internationally. Like, it didn't matter. Like, it basically just kind of took one of the most unique aspects from the series and threw that all in the trash. But this is an example of, like, turning what used to be like a mobile game, turned it into a single player offline, and this is how you do it badly. That's not the way that you would want to do it. You would hope that, like, they restore it in a way that, like, honors the original game and reflects all the events that happened in it in a way that was, like, obviously stripped out the gacha and, like, the further monetization and presented in a package that was more, like, you know, easily more palatable to a single-player experience, like what they're doing, let's say, with, like, Octopath Traveler Zero or, like, even Final Fantasy Resonance, etc. Like, those seem to be two good examples of that, plus, you know, there's others, but this seems to be, like, a really bad example.
Yeah, they just want to cut corners to get this put out, I would say. I get it, they're not, like a Square Enix, but I don't know. I want something that plays like the original, not like what I got here. Is this, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, so basically how this version works is that you get, like, you basically go on missions, like, immediately. So there's, like, no place to grind, you just keep going missions, and each mission is like a boss battle. And the boss battles are kind of, like, tuned to a way that you're just kind of button mashing until you just get to the end. And
but it has its own controllable characters, like, from its work.
You basically adjust the party before you go into battle, right? Like,
and is it only, like, a slice of the characters? Obviously, being used to be a gacha game, I imagine there was a lot of characters that came to it.
No, apparently from what I researched in gacha game is that there actually wasn't a ton of characters.
Okay.
You basically start out with, like the core group, and you basically have the core group for the rest, and you're, like, rolling for, like, new clothing and, you know, like, cards for them or something like that. So they, like, have different outfits or different variations of the same characters, right?
Okay.
But here it's like, yeah, there is no gacha, no everything. And then it's because you're, like, zooming through the events. It felt like, it's like, imagine watching the Dragon Ball Frieza arc, and it's like, it's over in, like, two episodes instead of, like, wasting, like, 300 episodes to get to the planet or something.
Oh, could be an improvement.
You know, it's like you're
yeah, zooming. Not that you say it like that.
It's like you're, like, zooming through, like, their character development. It's like, hey, it's like, why do you hate this person? It's like, oh no. It's like, then immediately the next episode they're already having, like, this part why they hate this person. It's just like, it's really, like, zooming through the events, okay? And Also, I do not like this main character because he's like so bare bones, and you don't even have any choices. Like his dialogue options, like are like stuck with like one choices. I think they probably remove all like the romantic choices and leave him with like the choices where he's like trying to be the straight man or something. I don't know.
Okay. So. All right. So far the original game seems to be mostly intact and has some neat additions at the cost of like unfortunate censorship. And then the actual two new quote unquote new things that were added to this collection seem to be big misses so far.
Yeah, I don't think this is what I wanted. Like, you could give me the gacha game, and I don't care if the gacha game's terrible, but I want something that resembles the gacha game, you know. Mm-hmm. You could strip its gacha away, blah blah blah, but you know, it's like if I got Grand Blue Fantasy and eventually it became AOS, and then it comes to like some kind of package, and then it plays like Relink. It's like, yeah, I don't care that it's nice. It's like, I love Relink, but I want the OG game, the OG experience, right? I mm-hmm. want to see what that plays like, right? I don't care if this new thing is better. It's just, I prefer something that's original, right?
I think of like a case-by-case scenario, because there are definitely some gacha games that like played so terribly that I wouldn't want to
want them to.
But, like I think of like Heaven Burns Red and like the Near Reincarnation. But both of those I really like, except playing. So I think for me it's a case by case thing, because I don't ever wanna fucking
deal with the
gameplay systems.
I'm just kinda like in a more preservation kind of mindset.
I get it.
Yeah.
But I also want them to be enjoyable too. I think everything else about them is good. I just want them to be enjoyable. Like imagine if Sin of Alice got a offline release. I would not want that game to play like its original.
Oh yeah, you were never able to play it because you had to find feel at the right time to do
it. You barely played it. Yeah, like I mean, it's not even just the Daily Guild War. It was just like it just felt like an offline. Like it felt like a single player auto battle thing that like you just happened to be part of like this five player formation that you have no control over really, or only one control, and it just kind of played itself for the most part too. So for me, it's like a case by case thing. Like if the original gameplay was like not good and you think an overhaul would make it enjoyable for everyone plus keep all the non-gameplay elements intact if they were already great, I think that mixture of best of both worlds is definitely more of a plus for me than the original is always right or should be always preserved. It's like for me it's like what's most enjoyable to the player
overall. I guess but yeah, that's my mindset for Sun. I'm in the preservation mindset. And finally, we got the last game of the collection, which is Blue Reflections Eye.
Second Light.
Oh yeah, Eye is the Japanese title, but yes, mm-hmm. Second Light is the sequel, the direct sequel to the first game. And I reviewed it before, and yeah, this is the best game of the collection. Okay, and I think this is the most like least changed game, just because it kind of released like the latest. So there's like hardly any changes in this game compared to the rest of the games, right?
I heard they took out this feature called ether crafting in it. I don't know if you engaged in that at all, but I heard like there was no ether crafting.
I believe that they only took that out for the new characters. Technically, Blue Reflection Sun, you get some extra characters into it, and they're kind of missing some of their things to make it that they're not as good as like the original cast in gameplay wise.
Oh, are they actually like missing like gameplay system features that makes them like, I guess, less or feel underpowered compared to like the original native cast?
Yeah, you beat Reflection Sun, and then you get those two characters. You get like some extra characters to it. But yeah, they're not at their full potential, I would say.
Here, like I remember them advertising like, hey, you'll as part of the quartet, you know, release, like there'll be some characters from Ray and Sun that you can port, that'll be ported over to Second Light as part of the quartet release. They just didn't.
And they also that. I was gonna say they also have no interaction in the story, right? It's like, you imagine you're playing a game and you get a DLC character and you unlock the DLC character and the DLC character has no interaction in the story. What's an example? Maybe Fire Emblem would be an example? I don't know. Maybe you got like, I don't know, someone from a different game and then they're, yeah, I got like Sigurd in Awakening, but you know, they're not doing any story interactions, right?
Yeah.
Not quite the same, but I was thinking like Tales of Symphonia 2 when you get the original cast. They do play in the story, but they don't have the monster training and all that stuff. Like they have their fixed skills that you can't improve or can only very limitedly improve.
I mean a very easy, somewhat recent example is Super Robot Wars, where like you have DLC 1 and 2. The characters in those will only be relevant for the stories in their self-contained DLC, but like when you go over like to the next DLC, like say DLC 1 characters won't be in the DLC 2 story. Obviously they have their own story campaign, so they don't, you know, interact. And when they're both back in the main game, since they weren't really accounted for, there might be one or two lines happenstance here and there, but they're not really involved with the overall core main story, at least later.
So, Chad, how long did it take you to like go through all of Blue Reflection Quartet, like each of the four parts? We know the second part's 30 minutes.
So the first part is about 20 hours. The original Blue Reflection wasn't that long a game. It's technically, I believe it's like 12 chapters, I believe. And each chapter can range from an hour to 2 hours. It's a very short game, right? The second game is about, or Ray is half an hour. And then Sun is about six. And then...
Wait, Sun is about 6 hours?
Yeah, it's very condensed. It's like a very condensed.
Oh, okay. That's more than I thought. Okay. Like I was expecting something like Ray, like, oh, I just got...
No. It has gameplay, it has a bit. It's very condensed. You're zooming through it. And then Blue Fiction 2 is about 30 to 40 hours, depending on how you're playing it. I would say, this collection's worth its money. We never played it before.
Yeah, if you have never had Blue Reflection. But here's the important part. Do you think this collection will do well enough to carve a path forward for Blue Reflection? Because obviously I feel like there's like the last chance, let's say, that it feels like a proof of concept, like, do people still care about Blue Reflection as a franchise? Let's do one more package for like quote unquote everything.
I think we can already answer that. We've seen enough about how the game is sold on like both PC and like in Japan to say that no, it didn't.
Yeah, I don't think there's any hope for this franchise. I feel like what's missing in this franchise is more like its budget. I feel like if they put the same effort as Atelier games in it, I feel it sell. But at this point, I think it's a missed opportunity. I think they already missed that boat. It's been too long.
I wonder if they're going to do, I don't know, not really a collection, but I wonder if they're ever going to do something similar to like Knights of Azure, because you mentioned it earlier, because it only ever got those two games, and I don't think it got an anime or a mobile game or anything, just those two games. And I wonder if they're going to do something for that eventually.
I also didn't know the Azure. Oh my god, the second Azure was not good.
Oh, no. The first one was okay.
You know what I wish they would do, and they will never do, even though it would be really cheap for them to do it, and stupid that they never fucking localized it. You already translated Arno Surge. You did a remaster of Seal No Surge and Arno Surge. Just fucking do a translation for Seal No Surge and let people buy that remaster outside Japan.
Yeah, I remember when that was that remaster was coming out, and they also announced it for PC. I'm like, oh, are they actually gonna release it in the West? Like, no. Like, oh, okay.
You can't even buy it on PC if you're outside of Japan. Yeah. Like, I'll give credit to companies that if it's something that they're either not localizing or it's going to take a while to localize, you can still buy it on PC. Shout out to NIS for letting you buy Village in the Shade early, even if they weren't able to do a simultaneous worldwide release. And also congrats to NIS, because that game is actually selling well, which means that they're safe for never however many years. Genuinely good for them. But, man, I actually, like, when my first TGS, one of the games I deliberately picked up was that double pack for Seal No Surge and Arno Surge on Switch, specifically because I was like, I can't buy this on PC in the West, and I want to play these games. I still haven't played them, but that's besides the point.
Yeah, Blue Reflection Quartet, killer package for what you get for, was it just $50, Chow? The MSRP? I mean, in the US dollars.
Yeah, I believe it's $50. Yeah, so, but
yeah, I mean that's a really good price for what you're getting. Even if it's not like all of an amazing experience, you still get a lot for what you get.
And even like, I don't know, maybe you buy a physical. I believe there is a physical version somewhere. But back then, the original Blue Reflection, you can actually like sell that for like very good money. It's a very limited print.
Oh wow!
But I was like, well, I think it kind of degrades the value, or maybe it might bring it up because of all the censorship thing. I don't know, but who knows?
it's a shame that like it feels like they squandered a lot of potential with this release.
I feel like that's a problem. It's like I am just kind of like in the old school boomer mindset where it's like uncensored. That's so uncool. I'm not going to buy that. That's like the '90s kind of kids thinking, right? They'll be like, I'm just going to import Mega Man Zero because there's no blood when you slash Reploids and stuff. It's like,
people are afraid to not get something for whatever reason. Whatever reason it may be, they're totally, you know, in their right to obviously make a choice whether they want to get something or not. Whether there's a good reason or not for it, it doesn't really matter. But it's just like, it feels like, I don't know, Gus, I feel like Gus doesn't know what the fuck to do with this series overall. I think it has a really cool concept, like a turn-based magical girl RPG should, like, you know, on paper be a fucking home run, because that seems like a really cool idea, but they never really got past Second Light, where, you know, it seems like it was that peak of what they wanted to do, and then everything ever since then just kind of went down.
I feel like nowhere. It's one of those things. It's like Final Fantasy, you know? Like, back then, it's like, they complain why new Final Fantasy doesn't sell. They just don't put out games fast enough. It's like, you wait 10 years for a sequel to come out, it's like, everybody's gonna be old and dead by then, and then all the new fans know what the hell this is, right? And I think that's kind of like the same thing happened with Blue Reflection. It's been too long since the last game that came out. People probably forget about the franchise by then. Even Brian already forgot that. He used to talk about this game on a podcast. So...
Yeah, we've had a lot of these podcasts. That's my experience.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea if they're using this as a proof of concept. Like, hey, do people still care, or are they using this as like, hey, will this remind people about Blue Reflection before release or announce a new entry? And this is just like kind of the appetizer before announcing our new entry. Who knows? And what does Gust have these days besides Atalia in terms of like tentpole reliable releases? Is it just Atalia for Gust these days?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's probably just Atalia, because I guess they've been doing those like fairy tale like tie-in games, but I'm pretty sure they're just done with that. So unless they do another like tie-in RPG series, it's just Atelier.
Yeah, and I imagine that's probably not a healthy place to be in, where you're solely relying on one IP to keep you afloat. I would hope you would want to diversify.
Yeah. I know, like, Ryza did well, but my impression is that Yumiya didn't do nearly as well as Ryza. I mean, maybe Karya will do pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like... seems like there's some interest there, but I also know a bunch of people, a bunch of like Atelier fans, that they did not like Yumiya for very specific reasons. And
have a lot of friends who were Atelier fans that did not like Yumiya,
and I can agree with that, because it's like, man, I enjoyed Yumiya well enough, but from a gameplay standpoint, it was like, yeah, this isn't it. So.
And it seems like no one really cared about that Resli Rihanna like console spinoff as well, because it was tied to the mobile game and people felt sort of lost. Like, I mean, even though that was your more quote unquote traditional turn based Atalia game, it just seems like tying it to a mobile release that ended service in the West and now only exists in Japan, not the best call.
Well, do check out Chow's written review of Blue Reflection Quartet up on the site at rpgsite.net if you want to, you know, read what he wrote down. And listen to our episode of the podcast from like 5 years ago where we talked about Blue Reflection 2, if you can find it. All right, the second thing we're going to talk about, I believe, Josh, you're the one that put this on here for Xenoblade 2 Switch 2 Edition. Have you had a chance to play it?
Yeah, I've got a chance to mess out with some of like the more later stuff before starting a new game plus, committing to it.
Mm-hmm.
I was very flip-floppy. I was like, when I bought the upgrade and booted it up, I was like in my end game, like, you know, post-game save of Xenoblade 2. And I have never felt so fucking lost revisiting a game because you have like all these fast travel points of places I barely remember, maybe one or two if I kind of clearly remember, and then a whole bunch of systems that just, I don't fucking remember anything. I have a bunch of like side quests that like haven't been completed, and I'm like, I was like, okay, where do you get Momo? I was like, Tora's house. I'm like, where's Tora's house? And luckily Mikhail's guide like reminded me, like, oh, Tora's house is here. I'm like, oh, thanks, because I the fast travel in Xenoblade 2 isn't the most well laid out in terms of like you're trying to find a specific place. Like, it doesn't specifically show you Tora's house in front of you. You have to like scroll through like which Titan is it on, and then on this Titan there's like separate like subcategories depending on how many places there were in it, and within these subcategories are a list of like fast travel points. I'm like, okay, there's Tora's house, go in there, you'll get a scene, get her core crystal, open it up, and you'll get Momo. And then after I got Momo, I was like, okay, do I just do a blade quest, or should I just like start over? Because I feel so lost. I don't remember any of this game's like how combat system, where things are, what do I need to do? And I'm like, I'll just do New Game Plus. So so I got to briefly check it out, like in terms of like, you know, how it's running and all the improvements to it. I guess one of the big things that, obviously, aside from the frame rate bump and the resolution bump that we'll get into, one of the hidden features that people found out early on is they actually rectified the field skill issue in this update for the game, where, if you remember, there were some interactable environments in Xenoblade 2 that needed field skill checks from your blades, your equipped blades, to get past them. So let's say this air vent needed like this, you know, skill, field skill at level 2, and then another field skill at level 3, and you'd have to like rearrange like your equip blades to make sure that you have the proper ones equipped with those field skills, so they all add up to something that you can interact with in this world to use that air vent. So people often had to rearrange their equip blades, and then after they interact with that, they have to switch it back, because sometimes you'll interact with like a field thing, like an air vent, and then like you take 10 steps and it's a boss battle and your blade setup is all out of whack because you were doing that blade environment. In this update now, you no longer have to do that inventory blade equipping shuffling. It'll actually account for like your entire inventory of blades to bypass skill check instead, which was like, that's one of the big fundamental issues every single player of Xenoblade 2 had. That finally, at long last, yeah, how many years later, got fixed, you know? That's something that should have been there.
The number one criticism for even people who liked or loved the game would be like, the blade skill thing is fine. Like, no one liked it. Just some people were annoyed by it and some people were put up with it. So if it was like that when it launched, like, that game probably, this isn't the most important thing, but like probably would have just scored like a half point higher is on average, just because that was the one thing that everyone agreed on could have been tweaked.
Yeah. The only unfortunate part of this thing is, like, let's say you just want to interact with like a field environment that has like very low skill checks. It will still cycle through like all your blades in your inventory. And if you have a lot with that field skill on, it'll cycle through them. And it could, what should be like, like say a 5 second interaction before may turn to something like more 25 to 30 seconds for like low level skill checks on that end. So it's like one of those things that's like, overall it's a net positive, but it does have some unintended side consequences that there are some negative aspects about it, but overall a net positive on that end. Seeing Xenoblade 2 running in 60 FPS feels criminal. It's mostly stable there. It's very smooth even in cutscenes. But there are still some animations that are very noticeable that are at 30 FPS. Like, for example, facial expressions. Like when someone's smiling or blinking, that's running at 30 FPS. So it does look a little bit jarring in that aspect. When characters are turning, that is still in 30 FPS as well. Like in scenes when they're turning, that's a little bit jarring as well. Because you can definitely see when that the different variants in frame rate. In that regard, I think that's like the most noticeable aspects. Of course, there's probably some environments here and there that I'm not aware of that have lower performance.
I heard that it has double. I have not proved this myself. I've not played it, but I've heard it has double buffers VSync, which means it kind of swings between 30 and 60 depending on where you're at. Like, and if you say that specific animations are also at 30, I could see that being kind of something that could be something you have to get used to.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, it's not as elegant as you want it to be, but it is still a step up from Xenoblade X, and in some
cases, the bar was low.
Yeah, the bar was low. It is a step up. Xenoblade 2 benefits the most because its base was rough. So that now seeing, you know, a lot of like these, what was blurry back then now be much crisper now, is a net positive because the original was in a rough shape. This is one of the Switch 1's earliest games, like in 2017. So, and remember, I think that Switch 1 like announcement video, like that Xenoblade 2 was already being teased before the Switch 1 was coming out. So it's kind of, you know, crazy that I was able to release so early in Switch 1's lifespan and still be like as good as it was, you know, obviously not for everyone.
I'm remembering like it was announced early for December 2017, and then it went quiet. This is my memory, which we've already established is not great. And then I remember for a while, everyone was just kind of like, "No way, it releases in December. No way, we haven't heard anything. That was too soon. It's going to be pushed." And then it wasn't. It just like, "Nope, we're ready. Here it is." And then it released. Like, and then people got mad because it got shunned at the Game Awards because it was a December release and didn't get picked up and all that other stuff. But they announced it early. People thought it was going to get delayed, like just conventional wisdom. Like, surely it has to be. And then it wasn't. Like, it was, I don't know, kind of a surprise at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Overall, just I think it's probably the best Xenoblade update yet from the 3 now that it's released. We have Xenoblade 3's coming December. I didn't get to check. Really check out the Merc Mission thing. I saw some clips.
That's what I was gonna ask. Yeah,
I know it's like a real time system now where like attacks can whiff if you're not in range if they're hit. But like there's actually like hit boxes you have to account for, and all that stuff. But I personally haven't gotten to check that out because I was already too lost in the sauce of menus. I also realized that I guess I never picked up. I didn't pick up the expansion pass because I got review code for Torna separately. That wasn't part of the expansion pass. I didn't get code like a review code that had the expansion pass on it. So if I wanted to get like all the blades that came out after it released, even though I already have Torna, I would still have to pay $30 to get those as well, I think. And that's why I don't think I have Torna's Switch 2 update because I technically still only have Xenoblade 2's base release and Switch 2 upgrade thing that I bought. And I guess that method doesn't apply to Torna because my Torna is considered separate and not part of the pass, which is...
Well, if it's a standalone Torna, it just got an update to the executable.
That's weird because I tried booting it up like last night and it was still in 30 FPS. It still showed like the Switch 1 logo at the loading. I don't know how
it works. I remember.
Yeah, I updated my physical copy and it worked just fine. But granted, before I booted it, I like searched for an update. Like I force searched for an update. So maybe you have to do that.
Oh, already. Maybe I have to do that. I didn't first
search. Yeah, like as soon as I bought it, like or bought Xenoblade 2 upgrade pack, and then it's like then it started downloading the Torna update. I'm like, why is there a Torna update all of a sudden?
And oh, I did the Xenoblade 2 and it's upgrade update, like all those downloaded, like first before downloading Torna again, I think. So I think I have to maybe check update feature. I just never do that because I just thought I'd just do it automatically. Well, I don't know, maybe that's on me. all this is kind of confusing at times. I'm old. But overall, no,
it was confusing when I launched it, but at least slightly. The fact that it was standalone if you want and not standalone if you don't want and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then they did like the opposite of Future Redeemed in Xenoblade 3 where it wasn't standalone. It was actually proper to it. But it's the best update Xenoblade 2 is probably going to get ever. I mean, just in terms of like, hey, you have something that it runs pretty smoothly now and looks way, way better than before. For people who are just playing Xenoblade 2 for the first time, they have everything to gain. If people want to do Xenoblade 2 replays, obviously this is the ideal way to revisit it. And I guess like people are just becoming more aware, like, man, this game was... It has really, really stunning visuals when you weren't so blinded by its performance issues.
Yep. Now, Adam has to know. I'm asking for him. I'm sure he's curious. Did you get to see Momo's blade tree thing or whatever?
I got to see a little bit of it. Yeah, it's cool that they have like her skill affinity tree has like direct quotes from Xenosaga in there. The quest NPC in her blade quest line, Lazarus, it's like a new NPC in her quest line. The Japanese seiyu for him is the same as Ziggy from Xenosaga, which is a fun reference. Obviously, I guess this update also had like a good chunk of English voice changes because some of the returning the English cast couldn't return for this update for whatever reasons, whether it's like health issues or I believe one of them passed away, unfortunately. I know it's like for the battle narration, Zeke, and it's not for the whole game, it's just like for the new scenes,
battle chirps and voices. Things like that.
Yeah. For that. So some people have it cataloged down elsewhere, but I remember hearing about that. And Momo herself, obviously, the people who are like big into Xeno Saga, Xeno Blade lore, Xeno Universe lore, you know, are already having a lot of theory conjecture about like why does Momo have her memories? Seems like here from the Xeno Saga because it shouldn't be like this. Does her imaginary form mean the direct existence of the imaginary domain? And was that like part of like the new chapter in Xenoblade X Definitive Edition, which had like that whole rift placed? And then obviously the Future Redeemed stuff that happened in the last stretch of that DLC. You know, it's understandably reigniting that a lot of the fan conspiracies and theories floating around until, you know, we're all waiting for what Xenoblade 3's update will add. And what the Xenoblade Genesis will have in store.
One thing to mention is people did check the credits for the Switch 2 edition, and Bandai Namco is no longer in the credits. So that speculation that we had like a little while back, we still don't have full confirmation, but it does seem more and more possible that Monolith just owns Xenosaga. Oh,
I didn't know they took it. I didn't know about the credits stuff. Like in the in-game like credits roll or just like the images?
The in-game credits roll.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about the in-game credits roll taking them out. Interesting.
I remember people saying like it was kind of confusing to follow because like Cosmos had like a watermark or something for Bandai Namco, but Telos didn't or something like that, even though they're both from Xenosaga. And now Momo doesn't have it, which is interesting.
I didn't hear about the credits rules, you know, it really makes me wonder what hero they're gonna add to Xenoblade 3, whether it's gonna be just totally new or something referential again. If it's something referential again, everyone's gonna lose their minds.
Alan, hell yeah.
Okay, that'd be beast mode. If it was Alan, I'd actually kneel. That'd be so funny. Oh my god.
Ziggy would be good.
Ziggy would be good. I mean, anyone would go like she. Imagine if it was Shion, just fucking out Shion. It's like okay.
Shion, I think, is kind of like my least interesting Xenosaga character.
I mean, but her armaments are cool. Like the weapon she uses. But in terms of storyline, like it'd be way more impactful if it was like Chaos. Imagine if they added Chaos to fucking. Mm-hmm. That'd be... So we'll see. Sure. I mean, it's only a few months away, but. If it's something people recognize, and especially for Xenosaga, it's fucking over. It feels like the stars are aligned. and we won't get a clearer picture until maybe Xenoblade Genesis, who knows. But it is funny that people are pointing out, with Xenoblade 1 Definitive Edition, they added Xenoblade Kart. With Xenoblade 2 Definitive Edition, they added Xenoblade Warriors, or Xenoblade Musou, as people dub it. And then it seems like with Xenoblade 3, they're adding Xenoblade Tower Defense or some sort, or these Xenoblade Vampire Survivors, who knows? And they're just like, what are they planning with Xenoblade Genesis with all these scrapped ideas and concepts? Yeah. We'll see. They're having fun with it. I can dig it. I can support it.
I forgot. What was that thing called in Xenoblade 2? The one where you played the Taurus minigame? Upgrade Puppy?
Yeah, was it not Jump Jump? What was it? I just read it like a few hours ago. Some Tiger? Was that it?
Oh. That would be what they have in store.
Oh my god, dude.
And you have to play it all day just to upgrade a sword character.
Man. I think if you show Tiger anything in Xenoblade Genesis, I don't think Xenoblade fans will have like trauma, shared trauma immediately. No one wants Tiger anymore, man. I get it.
Thank you, Josh, for giving us a little bit of hands-on experience of what it's like to return to a game as intricate as Xenoblade 2 after many years away.
Have a panic attack, and it's like, I just want to start New Game Plus, actually. Fuck it. That was my initial reaction when I touched it for half an hour and just was mortified at how lost I was.
Mm. All right. To change tacks a little bit here, just for a short little diversion, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I talked about my time through basically June and July and late May were after Mina the Hollower, were a little bit of kind of a slow period for me. So I looked at my backlog and I said, I want to play through the Divinity games that I haven't played through before. The reason why is because Larian announced their new titles, or simply titled, I think right now, Divinity, back at the Game Awards last year. So I'm like, all right, here's a goodest time as any to play through my backlog. So I talked already about Divine Divinity, which is the first game in the series, and Beyond Divinity, which is like the interquel between 1 and 2, second game in the series. So in late July, or I guess throughout the month of July, I played through Divinity 2 and Divinity Dragon Commander. So just some quick little thoughts here, probably just hopefully like 15 minutes or so. Divinity 2, first of all, I hate all the subtitles for this because it was originally Divinity 2 Ego Draconis, and then they added the expansion Flames of Vengeance, and then they like combined them together and called it Dragon Knight Saga. But now if you go to Steam, it says Developer's Cut, and like whatever, it's Divinity 2. Like it's got like 4 different subtitles, but it's Divinity 2. This game, when I first went to go play to it, I thought it was like a game from, for some reason, I was under the impression that it was like a 2003-2004 era game, like Knights of the Republic 2 time frame, like around that time. That's what I kind of thought. But it was like 2010-ish, 2011. So this is like Mass Effect 1 and 2 time-ish, or Dragon Age Origins. So around there, but of course not nearly as kind of like high market in that sense. So while the original two games, Divine Divinity and Beyond Divinity, are kind of classically styled isometric RPGs, Divinity 2 is a third-person action RPG. It's what it is. It's very janky, but no, it's, you know, full 3D environments. You have your, you know, perspective from behind the player character. Everything's in real time. I don't think there's real time with pause. At least I never paused it. So it's just a conventional like third person RPG, a game that I think would be better perceived now. But if it was Larian's first time making that sort of game, so clearly they had some growing pains. It's very like compared to its contemporaries that released around the same time, not nearly as polished, very buggy. And apparently this is also a game that does not have a like GOG preservation program sort of thing. So remember when Dark Souls 1 first released on PC, like you had to play it with the fan patch. Like it was a nightmare to experience without it. Apparently Divinity 2 is very similar. It's basically like, hey, if you're playing this game, you've got to go get Div 2 patch or something like that. Like, that fixes everything. It makes it play at high resolutions. It makes the frame rate not crap. Like, you, and I'm glad it was very easy to install, and I love when people are passionate fans and they do that, but it does not work out of the box well at all. Better than Beyond Divinity, but it's one of those things where if you're going to play it, you better put in that fan patch. So Divinity 2, I actually did not realize, is like the furthest along in the timeline. Not that I really care about the timeline, but I didn't know going in that nothing in the series has followed the events of Divinity 2. Like, it's been a not quite a cliffhanger, but it's been an open ending since 2010. And Original Sin 1 and 2 are like different prequels at different times. One way in the past and one kind of in the recent past. So I didn't realize that going in, that this game's resolution is it. And it might lead directly into whatever the new Divinity game is. This game definitely seems like Larian didn't know what they wanted to focus on, because it starts out as a very contemporary action RPG, fantasy RPG. You are basically finishing your training as a dragon slayer. What is a dragon slayer? Well, apparently the main character of the original game and a major character in the series, Lucian the Divine, was stabbed in the back by a dragon knight. So there are two different factions here, dragon knights and dragon slayers. It's kind of confusing, but that's what they're called. So dragon knights, they've been in the series the entire time. They've been in Rivalon, the setting, for forever. Primarily human, though I guess there are dragon knights of other races. Their powers are kind of like passed down through ritual and through hereditary means, like, and they can transform into dragons, they can ride dragons. They're basically like Jedi, but they're dragon knights. But apparently a dragon knight stabbed Lucian the Divine in the back, which is like the, you know, utmost act of hearsay, or not hearsay, of, you know, what a betrayal. So now the dragon knights have to die. So a new faction called the Dragon Slayers were created. And you are the newest dragon slayer. But you eventually learn that the dragon knights were basically framed. They were set up. They aren't actually bad. They were coerced into stabbing Lucian the Divine. So the dragon knights are actually good. And then you end up becoming a dragon knight. So you end up becoming both. Is that if I said the word dragon way too many times in the last 60 seconds, that's how the game plays too. So it's true to life. So you end up being an ex-dragon slayer, last dragon knight. And when I started this by saying that Larian really didn't know what to focus on, it starts out as like an action RPG. You have a melee weapon or you have a bow, and you press a button and you jump, you press a button and you swing a weapon. Like, it's very rudimentary, just action stuff. But then they, about halfway through the game, they say, also, you can transform into a dragon. Like, you literally press a button, and if you have enough space, you will be like third person behind a flying dragon, where you can like launch fireballs and do barrel rolls and above like the world map. And it sounds maybe like, okay, it's kind of neat, but it also means that the design of the world map at that point gets very strange, because you go from like well-crafted little valleys and corridors and villages and inside of buildings, and you're talking to NPCs and you're doing basic quests and you're fetching items and you're exploring tombs, to like a giant ravine, because it has to be so much bigger, like the scale of the map to account for the fact that you can, pardon my language, fucking fly now. Like, it feels like all of the design sensibilities kind of went out the window, because they just wanted on the tin, you can transform into a dragon now. Luckily with the fan patch, it works okay, but I've read that without the fan patch, it's even more like janky, like the frame rate's bad. There's a lot of collision issues. Whenever you're on the ground and if you see enemies around, if you transform to a dragon, all those enemies disappear. It's almost like it ports you to a copy of the map, that you're flying above instead of walking across. So it's like a key mechanical component of the game that I'm still not sure works very well. So that's part of the reason I think this game was not well received, or it just doesn't really have a clear design ethos. It also has a lot of other weird, interesting things, like it decided wanted to be core tenets of the game. Like, early on, you get introduced to basically a necromancer that puts together, like, as you defeat enemies, you might find like body parts, like, oh, it's an imp's head, oh, it's a dragon's arm, oh, it's, you know, and then you basically put together like a Frankenstein corpse as like your summon. It just seems very specific, but it's a very key part of the game that you have someone that you can summon that's like a thrall that's behind, that's, it's like, that seems very specific and weird, but I guess that's what you got. So you're an ex-dragon slayer, dragon knight that can transform into a dragon with a thrall that you can summon at any time. It just feels very kitchen sink approach. I didn't write down any notes, but I remember as I was playing through the game, there were a few other things that made me think of that. Like, instead of just giving you like a really cohesive package, it just felt like they were throwing things and saw what stuck. And some of it worked okay and some of it didn't. Oh, I remember the third thing. You can read minds. Like, any single NPC that you go up to, you can make the decision to read their mind at the cost of experience. So let's say you're 100 EXP away from getting a level up, but you want to read this NPC's mind to see if they're like lying to you or if they hid something. It might cost you 200 EXP. So it kind of down levels you slightly in a way in order to do this, which again seems like a very specific, weird thing that they decided just to throw in there. But it also kind of felt like a lot of quest items or quest information you could not find unless you read the different NPC's minds. So it almost kind of felt like you were obligated to do it. So there was really no decision made. Like, you basically, if you wanted to do quests and if you wanted to find hidden items, you read everyone's mind. So it was kind of like this continual experience tax that you have to pay. And now, of course, there's some NPCs that when you read their mind, they have nothing interesting to tell you. So it was really hard to fight the urge to just like quick save.
Yeah, save every time. NPC. And like, is this worthwhile to...
Or go to the Divinity fandom wiki and figure out, all right, I'm talking to Joseph. Does he have any, should I read his mind? No? Okay, I'll save my EXP. So like, it's a system that I think could work, but not the way it was implemented. Very strange. And it's also the sort of thing where if a character said, you know, they hid a key under their pillow, that key would not show up in the world unless you read their mind. Like, you couldn't bypass it, if that makes sense. It wasn't just tips and tricks. It was, if you want to proceed or find the secret, you have to do this. Very strange. Also, the original game kind of ends at a very weird open ending, not quite cliffhanger. Luckily, that is corrected for and has ever since the expansion, which released like a year later. The expansion definitely kind of reins things back in. You don't really ever need to transform into a dragon in the expansion. The questing kind of gets a little bit better. It's a little bit more confined to a city, and you're actually like engaging with NPCs, and some of the quests like overlap each other. Like, I thought the expansion, like, if without that, I would have ended this game with a very sour taste in my mouth. Like, man, that was not good at all. But the expansion did redeem it in a lot of ways. Is this worth playing? I don't think it's very good, but I'm glad I played it just because it's an interesting game. Even if it's interesting for kind of weird and bad reasons, it's an interesting game. And luckily with the fan patch, it's relatively easy, at least on my setup, to have it play nice with modern computers. So that's Divinity 2. And it'll be interesting to see, because obviously the amount of players that jumped in on Original Sin, going into whatever the new Divinity game is going to be much higher than the players preceding that point. So I'm curious to what extent they will expect that, you know, whatever's this story events to be known, or if they'll kind of like ramp everyone back up to be on the same page. And that's even assuming that Divinity, the new game, follows it. It might be a prequel or it might be something completely different. I just don't know. Oh, I have one other little point here before I go into Dragon Commander. Remember in Beyond Divinity, I said that the whole game, you are basically attached to this Dark Knight, this Black Knight, Death Knight, that's it. And you learn that they were a bad character the whole time, and the game spends like 5 minutes at the end of the game saying, you idiot, I can't believe you walked into this trap even though you had no choice, right? Divinity 2 basically does the same thing again. I won't go into detail, but basically you have a person talking in your head and you learn that they were evil the whole time and they led you to do stupid stuff that helped the enemy. Like, it just does the same thing again. I'm like, stop doing this. Like, stop. Just the only way to progress the game is to progress the game. And then when you do, they say, how dare you fall for this? It's like, I had no choice. I was just playing the game. So the fact that they did it 2 games in a row, I'm like, all right, come up with a new trick.
Get new material.
Yeah, basically. All right. So that's Divinity 2. Divinity Dragon Commander. This one I'm going to spend much less time on because this, unlike Divinity 2, which I thought was a not great game that I was glad I played, Divinity Dragon Commander is a not great game that I'm not sure I am glad I played. So this game is a weird, I don't know if it was like a passion project or if it was just Larian trying things. They were just like, oh, and this is like, I think it originally released like 2013, 2014. So a couple years after Divinity 2 and all of its expansions and all that. So this game is effectively like an RTS light. Takes place like thousands and thousands of years. Like if you look at like the official Divinity timeline or whatever, this is at the front. This is like thousands of years before anything. It's like the first emperor of Rivalon dies and is now his empire is being fought over by his three children, and then you, who is like a bastard child, but also you're a dragon knight. You could tell that Sven or whoever at Divinity really liked dragons, and it's Dragon Commander, so it's not a surprise. But yeah, you are basically a bastard son of a late emperor, and you're a dragon, and you want to fight for your birthright, right? Because everyone's fighting over this fractured kingdom. That, you know, that's basically the very high level premise, just to explain why there are different factions fighting over land. And it starts out basically a game that swaps between two phases. There's like a politics phase where you're on like your airship, basically like your point of command, and then you go into like the actual like conquest battles RTS gameplay, and you basically like jump between these. When you're in the airship, you have to deal with a bunch of different factions that you're trying to vie for support. It's like let's see if I can get these, the dwarves, the elves, the lizards, the imps, and I'm missing the last one. What was it? Maybe it's just humans. I'm forgetting the last. Oh, no, it's the undead. Dwarves, elves, imps, lizards, undead. And basically, they will ask you things that you have to like try to curry favor with them. And as you do, if you're fighting in their territory, you get bonuses or penalties depending on whether or not you curry favor. However, the way that this is implemented is very stupid. Like, I shouldn't say stupid, because that sounds so judgmental, but it's hard to come up with another word. You end up being at like a round table, and they will ask you like very direct questions that have a very, like, I think, a clear answer. And some of these questions, they are not nuanced at all. They're just like, hey, are you going to conscript people into your army? Yes or no? That's like question one. Are you going to provide medical care to your soldiers? Yes or no? Are you going to implement a childbirth limit for the imps? Yes or no? And it's like very like, what the shit are these options? Like, there's no like, there's no nuance. There's no like layers. Maybe later in the game, it gets slightly layered, but it's very like blunt political stuff. Oh, will you legalize this recreational drug? I wonder what this is an analog to. Yes or no? But what ends up happening is, because you're just trying to curry favor just to make it so that you get the most in-game bonuses when you're fighting in their territory, instead of making decisions based on like what I believe should be done or not, basically any decision will basically please three or four of the races and displease one or two of them, and they'll make it very clear like which way they would vote. So basically it's just kind of like playing to the crowd, where I'm just like, all right, I'm just gonna vote whoever I have the least favor with and just vote what they would want so I can bring them up. And then eventually, since more people like any solution than dislike, eventually you can just kind of get high favor with anyone. So it was very much not a like, it almost didn't become gameplay at that point. It was just like, all right, choose the option that fills the bars the most. Like, and it's very clear to tell you which bar that is, and you don't have to think about it. So it ends up being like almost a non-part of the game. And then the RTS part of the game is also very strange. Like, it starts out very classic RTS, where you have buildings that build units, and units can, be moved from one area to another to take over land or defeat other units. But also you can turn into a dragon. Like, it just goes back to that. And then I'm trying to think of something. Like, I don't play a lot of RTSs. But imagine you're playing Age of Empires 2 and you type in the code to get that car that shoots machine gun bullets or whatever. imagine you could then drive that car like from third person and then just mow down all your enemies. That's what turning into a dragon is kind of like. You just press a button on a meter, turn to a dragon, you fly over the enemy base, and you shoot them. Now, if they have anti-air or whatever, you might have to like deal with that. But it's a key component of the game is that you support your units by turning into a dragon. It's not very balanced. It's very easy to cheese. And it wasn't fun, basically, is what it boils down to. After doing a few RTS battles, like 8 of them, 9 of them, 10 of them, I ended up basically just doing like the auto battle. A lot of games have this where you like simulate the battle and you get like a percent chance to win, and then you might lose some units by simulating it. Like that's basically what I did, because the RTS just wasn't fun. Like I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to like treat it as more like a game of Risk than anything. And then basically the game ends, you reclaim your kingdom, hurrah, everyone's happy at the end. So it's like so divorced from any of the other story that it almost feels like it doesn't matter. Other than, I guess, you're a very early history Dragon Knight that other Dragon Knights might be, you know, descendants of. Like, maybe it might imply that, but it's not a great game. I'm not really glad I played it. But I guess I'm glad I played it so that I could tell this just to stay away. I have no idea if Larian has any interest to revisit, like, non-RPGs or RPG-like other genres, but this one feels experimental because it is, and I don't know that they did a great job, and I guess I'll leave it at that. So I know that's a bit of a tangent, but at this point now I've played every Divinity game.
Yeah, now when the next Divinity game comes out, you'll be the
expert. No, yeah. I don't,
right, so you're ready.
I'll probably replay Original Sin at some point just because it's been a long time. And when I played Original Sin, it was my first Divinity game. So I'm like, who is Zixx? What is the source? What the hell? Like, what is, I don't know any of this. So now that I have actually context for the world, it'd be interesting to play that to see like what references or what actual narrative ties there are. But yeah, Divinity 2, not a great game, but interesting. Glad I played it. Dragon Commander, you can skip it. Like, my opinion, it's not that good. But we'll leave it at that. All right. Before we get into news, we'll do some article shout-outs here. We already talked about Chow's written review for Blue Reflection Quartet. And then also, Mikhail did a comparison, one of his standard performance reviews of Blue Reflection Quartet, as well as some impressions for the Nintendo Switch 2 edition of Xenoblade Chronicles 2. Mikhail also did kind of a two-parter talking about, and I tee this up at the top, Cyberpunk 2077, talking about everything in terms of like the fact that Cyberpunk is now available on Switch 2, how it got updated for PS5 Pro. I think it has an official Mac version. Just talking about like trying to make this game, which obviously had a disastrous launch, you know, become available to play across systems. Like, I remember we had an article like, if you're playing this game and whenever it released, 2021, late 2020, like you can't play it on console, you have to play it on PC, and even then it's not great. And now they, you know, how far they've come since then. So talking about just the technical challenges of that, but then also you know, Cyberpunk 2077, like, obviously now has a second anime adaptation coming along. It's got a sequel in the works, you know, things like that. So both of those interviews are very lengthy, and you can tell that they're very passionate about what they do over there at CD Projekt, and they really love the kind of the reception that Edgerunners has had. Like, Edgerunners also is now getting like collaborations with like Wuthering Waves and other things. Like, it's interesting to see where we've come from the original, not just 2020 when the game released, but from the original teaser, like back in 2013, 2014, you know, long, long time ago. So do give those two interviews with CD Projekt Red from Mikhail a read through up on the site, rpgsite.net. And this last one's kind of an interesting one. This is a feature that was put up on the site by a contributor to the site, Jess Reyes. It's almost like other like online newsletters or whatever might have like a culture section or something like that. That's kind of where this one reads. It's about Jess's time at Anime Expo, which had some like presence by Hypergriff and Arknights. And of course, they just recently released Arknights Enfield, so that's kind of their current their current project that, you know, is still doing very popular. Chow, do you still play Enfield? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I do.
Maybe you can give me some context here. So I guess there's like a mascot called a Chubby Lungs. Like, what is
this? It means Fat Dragon, okay? Fat Dragon in Chinese.
Okay. Oh, really? Is that what it is?
Yeah, but it's like this balloon, this like dragon type mascot. I don't know like much about it other than it's just like it's their mascot. Like in the Arknights Enfield game, one of the characters you meet, Shang Yi, who's like kind of like the leader of this like the Chinese region in that place. She loves those things, and that's basically like their entire town is like decorated with it. So that's kind of like all I would say I would know from it. But yeah, they made it like their mascot kind of thing.
But apparently at Anime Expo, they had like the carnival games where you like throw a basketball into a hoop, but it's not a basketball. It's a chubby lung dragon. Or there's like a shuffleboard where you like slide one across. Like Jess basically goes into her time at Anime Expo playing like these chubby lung, these fat dragon mini games, and just kind of like thought it was interesting enough to write up about it. And she included some pictures from, you know, from the floor. It's just like I said, it's like a culture section of the site that we don't tap into that often. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of different. It's kind of interesting. And it's kind of like the sort of things that happen at places like Anime Expo beyond just demos or, you know, press events. So I guess this is a press event, but like
maybe this is more obvious to other people. But when I first saw this in my like inbox for, you know, the article, the pitch, I was like, chubby lungs, that's weird. It's a dragon? Why are they called chubby lungs? And then when it was pointed out to me that like lung can be also like written as long, like, oh yeah, long, like that makes much more sense to me as like a Chinese dragon.
Oh yeah.
So like, I guess lung is just sort of like an alternate, you know, way you can say it, like chubby lung rather than like chubby long. And it made more sense to me when I thought like, oh yeah, long is a word for dragon. So.
Okay. No, good shout for that. But yeah, just a fun kind of a fun little article by Jess on the site. So give it a read through. I think it's pretty cool. With that, we'll go into the news. I remember when this when I was first putting this together, I'm like, what is the main headline for this week? There doesn't seem to be much. And then the answer is maybe Super Robot Wars? Question mark. So I could read the headline here, but Josh, I think you're better equipped to tee this up more than I am.
Okay, sure. There was a 35th anniversary stream for Super Robot Wars that aired as of the time of this podcast recording several hours ago. So I was up at like 4 a.m. my time because I'm an idiot, but also because, you know, the series, you know, means something to me. And there was going to be like live performances by Jam Project that they weren't going to archive. So that was a lot of fun. The main news we knew of going in was there's going to be more like another update coming to Super Robot Wars Y, which released last year. It got like several DLC updates between DLC 1, 2, and an expansion pack. And then they announced an anniversary expansion pack, which is releasing just in a few days on August 5th, which will, I have to imagine this is the final content update, but who knows? I think it will be. But it is finally proper giving a proper conclusion to SRWY, which has been kind of lacking that ever since that game came out. So this, so all the new story missions chronologically happen after the events of the main campaign. So you can transfer your post-game save, your clear save into that game, into that expansion pack, and continue with your current save that way. If you don't have like a clear save to start it, you can also start it up from the main menu. You know, give you like a preset save data with like a, you know, all the units kind of beefed up for it. If you just want to dive in right away, this expansion pack gives several new playable units. Not as much as the previous ones. They note five of them. We know some of them. This finally gives Soleta from Mercury, her Gundam Calibarn, which is her final Gundam upgrade from that show. So I guess they're going to finally get into Gundam Witch from Mercury Season 2 story events in this anniversary expansion pack campaign. One of the more nerdy pulls was Lelouch getting the Byakuya Gekoi Sui, which is I don't think it's only been in the Code Geass Lost Stories mobile game, and that mobile game has like a lot of like original suits for the characters, so that's like a really deep pull introducing that into this game. And this will become relevant later as all the viewers found out, but they were randomly adding Crow, who was the protagonist from Super Robot Wars Z2, into Y, and he'll be like main story relevant, and all the DLC, all the previous DLC characters will like have some participation, like lines and story as well in that as well, apparently. But it was like at the time very random. It's like, oh, they're bringing in Crow, who to much of the English audience doesn't know him at all. Okay, cool. Like, Crow's awesome, but I don't expect anyone to know him. So like this will be about like 33 new additional missions, which is about like almost half of like the current length of the game, which is like, that's a beefy amount. And one of the cooler additions to this, as well as like all the new playable units, is that they are adding like 12 new attacks for the existing roster, but a good chunk of these are also combo attacks, which is already like combo attacks in a SRLV game are already like really cool when they happen, because they have, you know, they usually have multiple units from the same series, let's say like Gundam Seed Destiny, it'll have like, you know, Shin and Luna having like the Zaf combination red attack, or Atherin and Kira doing their combo attack. They have the Majestic Prince cast also doing their combo attack. So they're adding some of those like in universe in series combo attacks, like the whole like the five Gundam Wing main boys have their whole like five man formation combo attack, which you know, wasn't in the base game. But one of the cooler things that they, I don't know if they've ever done off the top of my head, probably in the mobile games for sure, but for a main console game, they rarely ever do it, is crossover series combo attack, which rarely fucking happens. The most notable of these are like the final dynamic specials, like from Go in the Guy series. So in this one, you have Mazen Kaiser, Mazen Emperor, Gene Getter arc doing their combo attack. You have Getter arc and Jet Jaguar, and Jet Jaguars for like the Netflix Godzilla series doing a combo attack. You have Elgai Mark II and Bilbine doing a combo attack, which is like, you know, that's just like really fucking cool that like crossover series get to do like combo attacks together, and some are like not relevant. Like Getter arc and Jet Jaguar have a pretty cool relationship in SRWY. You also have like Dino Zenon and Red 5, so like Dino Zenon and the Majestic Prince series collide, Combattler V and 5 and Raiden also have one. So that's, there's adding like a bunch of like combo attacks, and some of them are crossover series combo attacks. So like, that's like really impactful for long series veterans who like we're used to not really having much combo attacks. To see a bunch of them get dumped at once along with cross series combo attacks is like, that's really exciting. But that's, I understand it's like maybe not as exciting for people who are newer to the series that, you know, aren't used to like how rare we get these things. So that's the anniversary update. It's coming in a few days. There's also like a free update that adds like new anniversary missions and like boosted mode that makes resource accumulation easier, stuff like that. That's all good. But I believe the anniversary stuff, like the new story stages and stuff like that, is going to be paid. So that was like the usual, okay, content update for SRWY, might be the last one, probably. But the big one that people weren't expecting, and this is the thing that really made me suspicious about this stream, is because they were holding this stream not only in Japanese, but also had it in Chinese and English simultaneously. And they had like, you know, live translation translators, you know, dubbing over the event, which is like, you know, always commendable when that happens for any of these. So I was like, that's really unusual that they're doing this. And the big announcement coming off of that for home console SRW releases is Bandai Namco has announced that they are remastering Super Robot Wars Z2 Part 1 as Super Robot Wars Z2 Ruination Remastered. So people were like, understandably, what the fuck is this? Why are people excited for this? So Super Robot Wars, you know, very long-running series. Some of them get into, like, story arcs. So for the latter half of the PS2 era for SRW, you had something called the SRW Z series. And the first part of that, Super Robot Wars Z, was released on PlayStation 2. Really, really, really great game. One of my favorites in the series. And then it kind of got the Valkyria Chronicles treatment, though not as severe, but it did get the Valkyria Chronicles treatment where its sequel was coming out for the PSP, because that was like the more popular system in Japan at that time. You know, Japan had very big into portable games, handheld, etc. So its mainline sequel to that was Super Robot Wars Z2 Part 1, Hakaihen, which is roughly translates to like Break the World. And you had like this was a really cool entry that had a lot of titles that were popular in the West making their debut in this game. So you had, this was the first time Code Geass entered the series. You had Gundam 00, the first season, entered the series. Gurren Lagann. You had Macross Frontier and Eureka, like the original Eureka 7 series, but they're like the movie of it. You also had like a lot of returning titles, like Gundam Wing, the TV version, as well. And then a bunch of like series that were from the first Super Robot Wars Z entry on PS2. So you had like Zabungle, Orgus, Gundam X, Turn A Gundam, Big O, King Gainer, Querion. Kai did a really, really great like breakdown of this on the site, by the way. So props to him for helping me organize my thoughts on this one, because it's a lot. But either way, there's a really great series entry. But I know a lot of people are confused by, one, why is it part one? And two, why the sequel of Z1? So the Z saga of Super Robot Wars has like a pretty intricate overarching plot line. Z2 part one is isolated enough from the first one that it can stand as its own entry, though I know obviously this first part has like some callbacks and direct story tie-ins as the latter parts happen, but this is like the most popular one in Japan historically. Like, this is very, very well received in Japan. So part of the reason, I imagine, and some of that they stated in the live stream too, is one, this is historically very popular domestically, and two, the licensing situation internationally is easier to deal with for this entry. So that's kind of like the big thing going forward. As the Super Robot Wars series is becoming an international series, international franchise, the licensing rights situation becomes more of a nightmare, because you're not only just sorting it out domestically, you're doing it for the whole entire planet, or many, many other regions where a lot of these series, you know, where are the rights? Who do we get in contact with? Who do we get approval from? And all sorts of like paperwork and how many layers of management up the chain you have to get the green light from to make this possible and get to have the thumbs up that this is okay to do and no party.
Especially when they might change per region.
Exactly. Like the most famous one that people know in the West is the Macross situation that was just recently, just only a few years ago, cleared up after the whole Harmony Gold, I believe, like it was called Big West, was able to like sort that out and make Macross have an official presence in the West apart from Robotech. So that's kind of like the official reasoning, and probably like the most easiest reasoning why you're doing Z2 Part 1 first is because of those factors of the licensing internationally and being the most, you know, one of the more beloved entries in the fan base. But also, there's now speculation on my end, but I also think, because they also said they're going to use SRWY's engine for this remaster, which is Unity, I also think, just technologically wise, it'll be easier to adapt this entry into that Unity engine that they use for SRW. Why? Because the first Super World War Z on PS2 had like a tri-squad system where you could squad up units and have them move like multiple units as one. And so they had like a lot more layers of intricacies and systems that were stripped down when it moved to the PSP. And in the PSP, there was no squad system. There was like a single unit system that was very emblematic of Super World Wars Y and the recent Western titles for SRW. Just on a technological level, it'd be probably easier for them to work with the Unity engine with a single unit system than trying to whatever programming hoops and hurdles they have to get through for Unity to play nicely with like a squad system. Which on paper, it might not sound, all that significant, but if you think about game development and programming, it's not like as easy as copy and paste as some people might imagine. Things will break behind the scenes numerous times on that end. So that's some of the fan theories speculating why they're starting with this. Obviously, if this one is successful, or maybe it's already, being worked on behind the scenes, hopefully we see a remaster of Part 2 of Z2, because even though it's called Part 1 and Part 2, like, these are still full-ass games. These still take many, many, many hours to complete. Don't feel like you're getting half a title because it has Part 1 in it, or only Part 1 of Part 2, It's still a very lengthy game. But hopefully if this is successful, we'll get Part 2, and hopefully they go back and do SRW Z1 as well as part of this remaster project, this endeavor. Like, this is one of those things that I never thought would happen. I thought these were just, like, lost to time. These were really, really cool series, and the thing about Z2 Part 1 in particular has, like, a really nice world-setting build-up that kind of gets messy at the end once you start, factoring the overall bigger, larger Z story into it, but for a good like 3/4 of it, it has like a really nice self-contained like world build-up and story of like the world that they establish with the series that are participating. So this is confirmed for an international release. That's why they have the English and Chinese streams on it. Apart from just like being easily accessible worldwide and seeing like the wild live performances of Jam, like This was a thing that like caught me by surprise. I couldn't believe what I was seeing when they announced it. Even though like it's not, it was just the logo, I was like, it felt not real for like 5 seconds. I'm like, I thought I was still like half asleep when they were making this announcement. So I'm very excited. They still didn't announce any platforms or release date or window yet. They just said, hey, this is in production. They just showed a logo. That's it. I can definitely understand, like, there's a lot of, like, especially in Japan, like, there's a lot of frustration in some parts of the fan base where, since, they're starting with Z2 Part 1 instead of, like, Z1, that was on PS2. I can understand why people, are frustrated they didn't do the very first Z game and started doing the sequel first. And I get. And I really
assume the first Z game was also Japan only.
Yeah, these are all Japan only. Yeah, these are all Japan only. Yeah. And this is also funny because Z2 Part 1 was like getting a fan translation, but it was an AI fan translation. So there's a double kick in the nuts for those fan translators of like, no one was. Okay. Very, very little amounts of people. Very small amount of people wanted to see this game get an AI fan translation. This sucks. Like, why would you do this? So this coming out of nowhere is really funny as well, because it's like, nope, we don't have to worry about that anymore. We can look forward to this official release instead, which will be way better done than whatever AI fan translation slop they were doing behind the scenes for that fan translation. So this is cool. I'm very excited.
Win-win.
I'm looking forward to it. This is such a nice surprise. Unfortunately for any Super Robot Wars OG universe, original generation universe fans listening, they didn't announce anything for that. Unfortunately, Tarada didn't appear at all during the 35th anniversary live stream, unfortunately. No news there. I don't know if we're ever going to get something again in terms of like a main game. I still cross my fingers and hopefully we'll see something before, you know, before it's totally just hopeless, but nonetheless, I'll take what I can get. I'll celebrate the things that, you know, are at least confirmed to be happening, because I never thought this would be happening. So we'll see what they'll announce for this as we move forward. So I'm excited. I cannot wait. This is so cool.
The other thing that I had listed here as potentially a main headline, not a lot of like direct news, but I'll just give the announcement. We do know that 505 Games and developer Indolfinity are working on a direct sequel to Wuching, or I guess I say a new title in the Wuching series. Their first title was Wuching Fallen Feathers. So they are now working on a new game in that series. Whether it's a direct sequel or not, not sure. But the publishing agreement has been agreed to. So
I said important detail in this. It's like the original studio who worked on Wuching Fallen Feathers were disbanded and disintegrated.
I've been paying a bit of attention to it. My understanding is that the company on the Chinese side of things that was like managing stuff was like fucking over the actual team working on the game, and like the director was fired, and then the direct result after that is a bunch of the team left, and now that studio I think might just be shuttered. But it sounds like a lot of that team, including the director of the first game, are now working directly with 505.
Yeah, so if like a good chunk of them were able to land in this new studio in Dolphinity for this, then that's, you know, awesome.
Yeah.
Good for them.
I might actually go back to finish Wuchang, because I do know that apparently there is a mod that lets you revert the censorship changes now while keeping all the quality of life stuff.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome.
So, like, let me double check, because I saw people talking about that. Yes. Cool. There's a mod that came out literally just a few days ago, and it reverts the questline stuff, the enemy faction stuff, and the voice line and text, and whatnot. Yeah,
that's a win. That's a very good mod then. So, like, I remember you and I agreed that like Wuchang was a pretty solid title and had like some of like the best level design in a Souls-like game, and the way that they connected each of the areas. In that, I remember that's like one of the legacy memories I have of that game is like it has some rough spots. I don't like
it. It was just like performance. Just performance for memes. But like, yeah. I beat the game before the whole censorship with debacle. It was just like, yeah. I think we beat it like just a day when the game before it came out or before. It was a hard game, but I enjoyed like, I like most of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's like I liked what I played of it. I literally, the only reason I didn't go back to it was because of those changes. But
maybe
that was the original like Chinese company side of things. Maybe it's not something we'll have to worry about with it being under a European company primarily.
I think this time they probably realized that maybe the Chinese nationalists would get freaking upset, so maybe they'll, you know, work
out like.
I mean, I would rather if that's their original vision for the game and that's how it originally releases. Fine. I don't like something that they release and then they like patch over as like.
I know. But I'm just saying, like, if they make a sequel,
I know what Chow is saying. It's like it's. Yeah. Maybe because of what happened, they're going to like self-censor themselves before they even release the game.
I understand that part. I'm just saying that, like, if let's say Wuchang released what we consider to be post-censorship now, or like, you know, the post-censorship version, If that was the original release of the game, we didn't know the original vision for that game, I think it would have been just totally fine because we didn't know that was like part of the original product, right? So it's not like, so I don't want to put this sequel in a position where like it releases and I don't want to be accused of like, well, it feels like they capitulated to the censorship crowd, you know, for release or whatever. I don't like, I think that's unfair to the game if that was like, that's how it released, you know. That's like reporting censorship before anything, like, you know, as its final product, instead of like a patch that was clearly censorship.
Yeah.
But that's cool. I mean, I'm down for more Wuchang, you know, learn from the lessons from the first game, and I hope they, I really hope they keep the same level design philosophy. That is the one thing I really like from Wuchang, is the way that how all the areas connected with each other in a very, very, like, creative ways, and they were all very, very, and they had, like, a strong world setting and world vision.
And that was it we had for main headlines. I'll go into some trailers and updates here, probably pretty quickly. So this one is, we knew that a DLC was coming for Nioh 3. We got some details for it. Nioh 3 Hell Rising is going to be releasing on August 19th, which is a little over 2 weeks away. It'll have a new map in the Kian era, 1651. And I didn't know much about this, but I guess it includes a failed like coup d'etat against the Tokugawa shogunate. That's pretty cool. Not that I play Nioh much for the story, but it seems like an interesting setting. The trailer for this is pretty short. It shows a little bit of combat with the new weapon, which is like a lance and a shield. The lance is called a Hoko, I believe. So yeah, Hoko Spear and Shield is what they wrote in here. So I think that's brand new to the Nioh series. So that could be kind of neat to play around with. And then a lot of the expected stuff, like it'll have, you know, the original game only went to New Game Plus. Now it goes to New Game Plus Plus, you know, and tears up from there. So that'll be pretty cool. And I've actually been kind of playing my original Nioh 3 file, see if, you know, clear the cobweb, so to speak, to make sure that I remember how to play this game when the DLC drops. Because I always like kind of making a day of the new Nioh DLCs as they come out. So only a couple weeks away for Hell Rising.
And this is more of a coincidental fun fact than anything else, but this year that it takes place in is the exact same year that Fate Samurai Remnant takes place.
Hell yeah.
So when actually writing this, you know, this news, Kite was like that was the very, very first thing Kite pointed out, like, hey, that's the Fate Samurai Remnant time. Like, oh, I did not realize that. That's cool.
I love Kite for that. He's such a historical nerd about that stuff. It's so informative.
Another trailer for an upcoming game, like releasing in early access too soon, Expedition Samurai, within a week actually. So they did a gameplay trailer. I think this gameplay trailer is pretty neat because it shows some of the RPG elements of this game. It's not a pure tactical game, like using skills like skullduggery and diplomacy. The one thing I don't like about this trailer is the voiceover is very stereotypical. Like, how do I word this? This game takes place in Japan. Are you aware this game takes place in Japan? We're going to use a Japanese accent for a voiceover. And then they say, like, even the way the dialogue is phrased, I almost feel like it's a little over the top. Like, can you lie with honor? And things like that. I'm just like, I don't know. I just really didn't like the voiceover. Like, the gameplay looks good. If I watched it mute, I would be like, okay, it looks pretty neat. But just, I thought they were hamming it up a bit for the setting, which maybe there's nothing there, maybe that's just a me thing, but it was my genuine reaction watching the trailer. I'm like, all right, I think this trailer would have been better just without voiceover. Like, if it was just subtitles, I would have read it and would have been good. But I'm not really interested in the early access anyway. Well, I'm interested in hoping it does well, but obviously I will jump in once it hits full release. So because I'm really rooting for Campfire Cabal and hopefully for this to be a success. Sakana Rice and Ruin, Hinuka's Traversing Spirit Tale. This was a mobile game that was released in February, but has already, it's either shut down or it's planning to shut down. Looks like it did shut down as of a couple days ago. So it only lasted about 6 months. However, they have some like story that has, you know, basically been conceived and prepared, but the game is now shut down. So what the developer is doing is they're going to be releasing like the story cutscenes to their YouTube channel. So they just uploaded like a chapter 5 just story synopsis, like over an hour long to their YouTube.
And mentioned another one. This was a Japan-only game. It didn't get a release in the West.
Right. But it just seems like, hey, a game that, you know, they've seen this before, just did not pull in the audience that they were hoping for, so they shut it down, but trying to get what they can out of, A, the players that did play through the story, they want to see how it was intended to end. They're going to have the story events available, at least in video format. They released some now, and they're just going to put the final story chapter up at the end of September. So, kind of unfortunate news, but it's, I don't know, it's kind of an interesting little situation that I don't know if I've seen like an analog for that before. But if they already have the story events kind of voiced and art already made, at least this way they can present it out rather than having it stuck in, you know, someone's ArtStation account never to see the light of day. So I think that, you know, silver lining, this is something somewhat neat to come out of a project that did not live up to expectations, clearly.
Yeah, I think Sakuna, like, cool game, but unfortunately the IP, it's like, it kind of, it grew too fast to the point that, like, they're trying to squeeze as much as they can out of the IP, for better or for worse, because obviously it did get like national coverage in newspapers in Japan. Like the agriculture industry really rallied around this release. But like, you know, within, you know, a few years after it came out, got an anime adaptation, we got this mobile game thing. I think they have like this new side story spinoff game also in development as well. It's a really hard call of whether like this, like whether a very successful release will have actual legs for, you know, multimedia project. This kind of like the unfortunate thing when you really try to overextend for what probably has like, you know, some fans but not enough to support it like long lasting. It's not like you'll have a huge audience of like, yeah, I'm going to wail for fucking Sakuna units that are not any of the characters I recognize from the game.
Adam, you played the original game, right? The Farming Sim? Yeah, but like, I'm trying to imagine, obviously, like, the mobile game was, like you said, Japan only, but like, hell yeah, that Farming Sim I played, I'm gonna latch onto the anime or latch onto the... I mean, I don't blame them for shooting their shot, but it does seem like they were trying to leverage what they could and kind of a, maybe like a shotgun approach fashion, just to try to see if anything stuck, and maybe none of it really quite did.
Marvelous has announced Sakuna Chronicles, Kokoroa and the Gears of Creation, which is like the time god, I guess, versus like the earth god in Sakuna, goddess, I should say. Like, that game was announced in November 2024, and I don't think we've heard anything about it since. And they actually, we don't know what type of game it is. Like, in terms of genre.
Adam, why didn't you support this mobile? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I thought Brian was going to ask, hey, Adam, which units were you going to wail for this Sakuna?
Yeah, why didn't you wail this harder? Anyways, so. One more update here. Eruta, you've talked about this game, Chow. You actually gave this to me. I need to play it. It was a PC only as of late last year in November, but it is going to be made available on PlayStation and Nintendo Switch. So no release dates, but also saying that it will get a physical edition for Switch and PS5, only digital on PS4. So, and they're also still working on post-launch updates and DLC.
I was going to say, I'm definitely hype about this thing because there's a physical release announcement with it, so I'll get the Switch version whenever that comes out. But I actually also wanted to buy this game as a birthday present for James, too, but I just forgot what day was his birthday, so I didn't give it to him.
Tomorrow.
So I just bought it for Brian that day, and that was it.
It was a neat game the way you described it and kind of mini-reviewed it. Early this year, I think, or was it late last year?
I didn't do a review. We just talked a lot about it in this podcast.
Like mini review in like the podcast format, like, you know, review analog, so to speak.
I think Mikhail also like bought the game because I said I liked it. He's like, this better be good, but nobody touches it, so no one can get their fair shake of it. So, I bought for Josh as well too. He needs to put it.
I need to play
the Eruta evangelist.
Yeah, so. Buy everyone a copy of this game.
Well, it's cool to see, like, we're not going to see, you know, many more of those announcements for physical. Well, I guess, you know, I guess this is another whole can of worms. Like, even if Sony no longer manufactures discs, you know, maybe some boutique publishers could make physical boxes, even though obviously there would not be a disc drive to put a disc in. I don't know. That's going to be weird. Oh, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. Sales update. Pragmata has sold over 2.5 million copies worldwide. So that's pretty cool. Let's see, a few release dates for August and beyond. Star Sand Island is a farming sim by a publisher, self-published Seed Lab. So I guess it was in early access since like last February, and it's going to be releasing out of early access on August 18th. Alongside the announcement of that, there was a release date trailer, both in English and Japanese. So it's pretty cool. Stupid Never Dies. You played a demo or preview of this, right, Josh? You shared your thoughts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I forget if that was like a Steam one or if you played it at PAX. I'm just forgetting what the event was.
SGF.
SGF.
Well, pre-SGF, technically. It was like an off-site thing.
So Stupid Never Dies will be launching on PlayStation 5 and PC on October 21st. And I guess Sega, it has a hand in its publishing, which is kind of interesting.
Man, that release date that's after just a few days after Castlevania Belmont's Curse and Tales of Eternia Remastered, one day before Final Fantasy Resonance. Cool release date.
And one day before Demon's Night Fever.
Yes, that's the next headline. So we first heard of this game at the
Game Awards. I believe that last of the year, Stupid Never Dies, right?
No,
it wasn't the Game Awards. It was like a Arc System Works showcase.
Oh, you're talking about the other game, Demon's
Night Fever. Yeah, Demon's Night Fever.
Yeah, I thought you guys were talking about Stupid
Never Dies. Busy time to release all the games. What's next? Zelda remake at GTA 6 release date too?
Well, yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess we don't have that date yet. You're right. So that's another one. Who knows? But yeah, Demon's Night Fever. This is like we kind of teed up inadvertently. The published by Arc System Works, developed by Dreamcom and Super Niche. Kind of
RPG. Yeah, it's an obvious comparison would be to Sky, but honestly, it's more like this isn't a game that Ikawa worked on, but the overall gameplay loop reminds me actually more of Trillion God of Destruction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it is releasing on October 22nd. So, yep, right out one day after Stupid Never Dies, yeah. And, you know, also in a very busy
game is time. Pretty neat. I would like to play the full version. So.
This one, I believe, is a new announcement. Correct me if I'm wrong. A new Senran Kagura mobile game called Shinobi Nexus, Senran Kagura, is launching for PC and mobile devices in Japan in 2026. So I guess by the end of the year, we don't know a specific time.
Yeah, it's like we're pretty far removed from what the West remembers of Senran Kagura because it's like a direct follow-up to the previous mobile game was like the Shinobi Master Senran Kagura New Link, and that was like shut down May of 2 years ago, last year. So like it's one of those things, like weird things where it's a new Senran Kagura, Japan only, the original creator is not there anymore, and it's mainly a new cast of characters that people in the West are not familiar with because it's a follow-up to a mobile game that shut down in Japan already.
Yeah, so. Keichiro Takaki is still at Psy Games, right?
Yes.
And of course, this game right now is also only announced for Japan, but it'll be releasing before the end of the year. And in Kite's little news post for it, I included the revealed trailer as well as the characters that have been introduced so far, as well as their Japanese VAs. And like links to the official site and all that stuff. And then the last headline I have here is that Tencent has canceled development of a mobile Story of Seasons game. So they're no longer partnering with Marvelous for that project. I saw some other headlines about this, like failed or this fall through from Tencent investing in Marvelous for this project. And then Kai did also go into a little bit of just how this is kind of in the flow of the wider trend of, you know, large Chinese major companies withdrawing from like different video game investments, like NetEase pulling out of, you know, shutting down Oka Studios behind Visions of Mana, Negoshi Studio no longer finishing Gang of Dragon, and a few other things that are in like the same vibe in terms of like all these larger investments that were made, you know, coming right off the, you know, COVID era, you know, and not, it's not just, you know, Chinese studios, it's Embracer, it's Tencent, it's a whole bunch of different large conglomerates having
that, that's, all, yeah, that's kind of the bigger, like one of the bigger aspects of the Stupid Never Dies release date is they also had like a co-publishing agreement with Sega that Kite reminded me of in this article, where like when that was first announced, it was like that same arrangement that the other studios where NetEase was funding the project. As we don't know what happened to that, there's no official word for it, but you know, if you connect the dots, Sega's now involved in helping them distribute it worldwide. You know, I even though nothing has been officially said, it doesn't take much to connect the dots of like, hey, this probably happened behind the scenes.
I do know that Daniel Mott actually posted on social media about how like this year's Tokyo Game Show exhibitors was like 30% less like Chinese companies exhibiting at Tokyo Game Show this year.
Damn, that's brutal.
So it's not just Tencent. It also seems like a situation where because of the geopolitics of like the current like Japanese prime minister and that whole can of worms, that a lot of these Chinese companies are starting to pull out from those business relationships, which I can't blame them considering the situation.
I mean, the state of geopolitics has been a fucking shit show. It's only because it could be a more of a shit show spiraling downward.
And I just watched on Jason Schreier's YouTube channel the, you know, a day or two ago, Tencent pulling out of their Last Sentinel project, which is supposed to be like their big GTA competitor thing. Like just another thing that basically had layoffs, that the future of that project is uncertain. So and that covers it for our headlines this week. So real cool to touch in on Blue Reflection's kind of remaster package, and Xenoblade 2 Switch 2 Edition, as well as some backlog games and some other headlines. Next week, I know we're going to be talking about Beast of Reincarnation, or at least I hope we are. What else is next week? I'm going to pull up, linked on the RPGsite.net, the calendar that Adam so stewards.
Super Bowl Wars, well, anniversary expansion back.
There's a lot of stuff I'll be able to talk about next week. Not necessarily stuff I'm playing, though also probably stuff I'm playing, but lots of stuff in the pipe that embargo lifts next week.
Cool. I actually don't know what you're talking about, so I'm also just eagerly interested to see what we have next week. So Beast of Reincarnation, a few embargoes, Super Robot Wars Y, its potential last DLC, and into a very busy time of the year. So we'll carry that momentum through from August to the end of the year. So stay tuned. You should subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a like, leave us a rating. We love to see those. Bookmark RPGsite.net. Leave us comments. Follow RPG Site on all the social media networks. If you search for RPG space site, you should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. And we will be back next week with another episode of the Tetracast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.
I just want to mention that the RPG Site Discord community fucking rules, man. Like, we just have really productive conversations about, like, when certain companies try to release generative AI slop. A lot of our community strongly dislikes it and just vehemently opposes it. And I'm so proud of them, of having thoughtful, mature, productive conversations with each other. Even to people who may disagree, they are very polite and just nice people all around. Heavily just, you want to meet some cool people and be part of a cool community, join that RPG Site Discord. We're so proud of them.
Yeah, it's really chill. No unnecessary drama. It's just, it's a good time. It's really cool.